If you're confused by this record warm winter, imagine the plants and the animals. All these warm temperatures are messing up their bio clocks. This hour, we'll take a look at how an early spring affects flower buds, beetles, and bees. We want to know what's going on in your garden, too. Plus, dark matter just got more mysterious. Two massive galaxy clusters slam into each other, leaving dark matter in their wake. Dark matter that astronomers say should not be there. Spooky. And planet or not, should Pluto get its own postage stamp? The leader of the New Horizons space probe mission is here to give us an update on the future flyby of Pluto and tell us why he thinks Pluto should be a planet and a stamp. All coming up after this break. Stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you look up at the night sky, everything seems pretty peaceful out there, right? Stars twinkling, planets rising and setting, maybe a meteorite or two. But there's actually some really violent stuff that you can't see, like two massive clusters of galaxies, and we're talking clumps of thousands of galaxies smashing into one another. It ain't pretty. Well, actually, it is pretty pretty, but we'll move on from there. Astronomers have watched all that happen, and when it was all over, when the cosmic dust settled, so to speak, left at the scene of the accident was a bunch of dark matter. Dark matter that they say shouldn't be there. At least if our current theories are correct. So how you can explain that one? Mystified by dark matter? Give us a call. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can tweet us at SciFry. And here to give us his explanations is Andy Shea Madhavi. He is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at San Francisco State University in California. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Madhavi.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Tell us, what was going on with this collision between the galaxy clusters? Is that a common occurrence?
No, it's not very common. So collisions of this magnitude are pretty rare. We only know of a handful of collisions that are this violent.
And so, Dr. Madhavi, why is this happening?
Well, so basically in the universe we have, we have matter like us, like you and me. We're made up of atoms, which are made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, and that's about 15% of the matter that's out there. And over the past 40 years, we've built up pretty solid evidence that actually more like 85% of the total mass of the universe, of the matter in the universe, is this mysterious substance called dark matter. So actually, dark matter is everywhere. Up to trillions of dark matter particles are passing through you and me right now without us even ever feeling a thing. But what dark matter does have is gravity. So every galaxy that we see out there, every neighborhood of stars, has this dark matter halo surrounding it. And these things are basically living a happy life together, 85% dark matter, 10% gas, 5% stars. But once in a while, the gravity of these things is so large that they just kind of fall into each other. And this particular cluster that we observed has a collision velocity of 2 million miles an hour. So it results in some pretty spectacular events. But one of the things that shouldn't happen is that dark matter shouldn't be pulled away from the galaxies. We think that galaxies and dark matter grow up together. Even in such a violent collision, they should stay together.
So what you observed is that when they collided together, the dark matter sort of stayed there while the galaxies moved off.
Yeah, and so it wasn't just me. It was a team of colleagues, including Dr. James Gee of UC Davis, who is to be really credited for a lot of work on this latest result. And we originally discovered it back in 2007. From the ground using telescopes in Hawaii, and now we've followed it up with space from the Hubble Space Telescope. Yeah, so what we saw when we saw these two clusters collide is that there was some dark matter stripped from the galaxies. Now, it's pretty normal for gas to be stripped from the galaxy, and you might have heard of another cosmic collision called the Bullitt Cluster.
Yes.
And so when that's also a couple of clusters of galaxies where they smashed together, and their dark matter wasn't misbehaving. So you couldn't detach the dark matter from the galaxies, and so the gas, of course, was detached, and we understand why that is. It's because gas is charged. Gas has protons and electrons, and so when two clumps of free protons and electrons hit each other, they will slow each other down. But dark matter has no charge. That's why we can't see it, because the only reason you and I could see anything is because there's charges that are being accelerated. That's what light is.
Mm-hmm.
But if something has no charge, it doesn't give off light. So, yeah, so in the Bullitt cluster, dark matter and galaxies stay together just as they should, and in above 520, they do not. And that is a mystery as to why exactly that is. There isn't a comfortable explanation that that can be readily arrived at.
Is there a theory that what may be happening, or just you have to just think about it some more?
Well, so there's a number of things that could be happening. All of them are slightly disturbing. So the first thing is that, well, why did in the Bullitt cluster dark matter not get left behind, and in this cluster above 520 dark matter did get left behind? Well, one thing that could be happening is that, and this is kind of the explanation we want to avoid the most, because it's really requiring some pretty big rearrangements of our thoughts about our cosmos. So we actually set out to disprove this possibility with the Hubble observation, because we were so disturbed by the original 2007 findings. One possibility would be that dark matter has some stickiness to it, and that stickiness depends on how fast you collide things together. So if you collide them really fast, dark matter doesn't stick together, but if you do collide them somewhat slower, there's some stickiness that comes into play. And so it stuck in Abel 520, and it didn't stick in the Bullitt cluster because of this velocity-dependent stickiness. Now, that's something that would be the kind of final explanation if we could rule out everything else. And, of course, the big job is ruling out everything else. So in our paper, we have a number of possibilities, but again, none of them are easy. None of them are simple. So if you wanted to have ordinary dark matter that has no stickiness, you would have to come up with some very convoluted mechanism for removing this cold dark matter from the galaxies that it loves so much. I mean, it just loves hanging out with these galaxies, doesn't want to let go of them under the cold collisionless dark matter theory, which is our main theory that I think we all accept.
Yeah, but if you stick with the stickiness idea, then you have to give up the other idea that you think you know what dark matter is.
Yeah, so we actually don't know what dark matter really is. These are all theories. Dark matter is not part of our standard model of physics. The standard model accounts for protons and electrons and neutrons. But one of the things that's really exciting about dark matter that makes it one of the deepest mysteries of the cosmos is that we know we are pretty sure that dark matter is not part of the standard model. So some physics beyond the standard model of physics is involved in the nature of dark matter. And because we're in the dark about physics beyond the standard model, we are in the dark about dark matter. We do not know what even its basic properties are, except the fact that it exists and it has gravitational force to it.
So you're even further in the dark now. About dark matter.
No, I think we're getting somewhere here. If we can sort of pull together our simulations here, a lot of simulation work is going to have to be done to really see how unlikely is it to get a freak clump of dark, collisionless dark matter like this one. Maybe there was a dark matter clump that formed out there somewhere in the cosmos by itself, and it was kind of starved of gas, and because it was starved of gas, it didn't make any galaxies really inside it, and so it wound up by chance in the middle of this collision. That kind of freak occurrence, we'd have to quantify the probability of that using simulation. So what's nice about this observation, it gives us a to-do list as far as what we have to check. And if everything we check turns out to be not possible, then we have to turn to this velocity-dependent stickiness idea. And of course, we want to avoid that until we actually confirm that ordinary collisionless dark matter couldn't produce the structure.
Hmm. Why don't we just catch some dark matter here if it's going through us all the time?
It's very hard. Remember, a has to have some kind of charge to be seen, so we cannot ever see it. It kind of just flows through us, so it really...
Sounds like a neutrino or something.
Sounds like a neutrino, right, exactly, except there's a very big difference between the neutrino and the dark matter. Neutrino is part of the standard model. So we understand the neutrino really well, and we know that the neutrino, like right now there is huge numbers of neutrinos also passing to you, which we believe are not the dark matter. These neutrinos we detect because we basically we go to places where it's really dark and really calm, like mines deep underground, and we fill these mines with things like heavy water or chlorine. And once in a while, a neutrino from the sun, neutrinos are byproducts of fusion on the sun. Once in a while, these neutrinos, one of these neutrinos will hit a heavy nucleus inside this water, and it will give off a little bit of light. So we have detected neutrinos, and we have modeled them in such a way to convince ourselves that they are not the dark matter. However, there are lab experiments going on looking for possible dark matter annihilation products. Now, what does that mean? That means that, remember, we're in the dark about dark matter. We don't know what the real theory behind it is. The one possibility of the many, many possibilities that are literally there is, you know, dozens of papers published on this every month about what could dark matter be. One of the possibilities is that dark matter decays somehow to some kind of regular standard model particle. And if it does do that, then we may be able to catch those decay products. So, for example, one possibility is we could detect neutrinos that were left over after dark matter annihilated or decayed. And the way we would know those neutrinos are from dark matter and not from the sun is that they'd be coming up from the center of the Earth. So they'd be coming from the wrong direction. And so there's experiments right now underway to try to catch these putative products of dark matter decay in the lab. And thus far, they have not really been successful.
So it's easier to look out into the galaxies and do a
big experiment
that way.
The galaxies really are the thing that told us dark matter had to be there, the clusters of galaxies and the galaxies. And also models of the early Big Bang also tell us so many different lines of evidence over the years, hard work of so many distinguished people over the past 40 years have really brought us to this.
Well, it looks like you have a lot more interesting work ahead of you now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andishay Madavi, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at San Francisco State University. Interesting stuff about the dark matter. We have been following it, and we'll continue because it's such an interesting topic. We're going to take a short break, and when we come up, we're going to talk about the winter, short winter weather we're having here. And if you have some evidence in your backyard, you know, it's been very warm. What's happening? What's coming up? What kind of action do you see that you usually don't see this time of the year? Give us a call. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We'll be right back after this break. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions, we've listened to them, and over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday. A newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's been a pretty warm winter out here in the East, hasn't it? Well, actually all over the country. And, you know, it turns out all the lower 48 in January was the third least snowy on record, the fourth warmest winter on record. Only New Mexico had a colder winter than record, and all four of these have been within the last 20 years. And I'm not complaining because springtime temperatures are okay with me. I get out in the garden, but, you know, when you go out there, what do you see? You see the early spring buds. They're bursting. The leaves are growing. I was out pruning my rose bush already. Bees are buzzing, the squirrels are out, and if the climate change is running its course, is this sort of the new normal for us? What do you think? Our number 1-800-989-8255 is here. Well, let's talk about what you're seeing that's happening in your neighborhood about early signs of an early spring. And we're going to talk about why that may not be such a good thing. that spring is happening so quickly, because what is happening to the flowers and the animals and the bees? We're going to talk about it with my guest. Kristen Schleider is acting director of outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx, one of New York's jewels in the Bronx here. She joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Happy to be here.
Thank you, Dr. Schleider. Tom Turpin is professor of entomology at Purdue in West Lafayette. He joins us from the studios of WBAA in West Lafayette. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Turpin.
Well, good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Are you seeing an early winter out there?
Well, are we seeing
an early spring, winter? Spring.
We are seeing an early spring. It's been one of the milder winters that I can remember, and that's getting to be a number of years now.
Yeah. Dr. Schleider, what's going on in the garden now? Have you seen signs of things happening early?
Sure. We have all sorts of things happening early. A lot of trees that usually would only have would be beginning to bloom right now, they're already done with their bloom. Yeah, we're early.
And we were talking about that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that keeps track of the growing seasons in different parts. If you're a gardener, you know that there are different parts of the growing season. The zones there. They've changed the zones, right?
Yes. Here in New York and along the coast here, instead of being sort of the warmer 6 zone, we're now the cooler 7. So we're getting warmer.
Wow. Tom, has your zone changed at all?
We have changed our zone here in Indiana as well, but Kristen may tell me differently, but I'm not going to plant any of those plants for a little while yet to find out how true this may be.
Well, we've been planting a lot of those plants already to see if we could sneak them through, so now...
What plants are you talking about?
Oh, things like Japanese apricot, the Prunus mume, or Mahonia, Oregon gray pollies... Edgeworthia, the paper bush, we've gotten to come through. We have one garden called the Ladies' Border, where we really try to push the zonal plants, and that's where we've gotten most of those plants to come through really beautifully for 10 years already.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. But Tom, there's a downside to this with insects, is there not? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say a downside in that you think we're going to have more insects as a result of the warmer winters.
Aren't we going to get more pests coming out earlier?
Well, I don't want to shoot this balloon down here, Ira, too much. But the truth of the matter is that warm winters generally would result in maybe more species of insects. Mm-hmm. But if you talk about individual pest species, you almost have to talk about them individually, because some actually are helped by a warm winter while others are harmed by a warm winter. So I don't think we can generalize as far as the insects.
Good. Well, give us specifics then about which are helped and which are harmed.
Well, take, for example, a insect that has become kind of a pest insect, the Asian ladybug. Now, it's beneficial to many of our growers, our gardeners, because it feeds on aphids. This insect overwinters as an adult. It overwinters in sheltered places. And basically, when we have warm winter days, it breaks itself out of hibernation, goes searching for aphids. And I think Kristen would agree there are very few aphids on our plants out in the middle of the winter. So there's no food for it. So it's using up its stored food resources in its own body, meaning that it may, in fact, not even survive till the springtime when it should begin to lay eggs. So there we have an insect that would be actually harmed by a warm winter. Another example might be the honeybees. Honeybees are social insects, and they then spend the winter as a group, a colony. During the winter, they're out flying around looking for pollen and nectar, and Kristen's plants are not providing any of that in January and February here in Indiana for the most part. So they're using up their colony supplies. The clusters in the colony then may not form as tightly, and so the egg laying and the brood formation maybe doesn't do as well, and we might see that colony is going to be impacted by a warm winter.
Kristen?
Well, I have to say, we did have an awful lot of honeybees that appeared the very minute some of the plants opened. So definitely they were active because it was warm and looking for food. So I guess we have some lucky honeybees at the garden because they were well fed. They've been well fed through February.
Is there some risk that this is a false period of, you know, we may get a big cold snap that comes in below freezing temperatures and might kill off some plants or insects that might not survive?
Certainly from the plant point of view, we could lose bloom. Certainly, a lot of the buds are beyond the point of no return at this point. But the trees or the perennials probably wouldn't be damaged for the long term. You just wouldn't have your flowers this year, especially if it's a once-blooming plant.
Mm-hmm. And what about fruit, you know, that are setting their flowers?
Absolutely. If you lose, for instance, apricots, very early blooming, if you lose your apricot flowers, then you have no fruit for the season.
Tom, you agree?
Well, actually, I think it's true that that the insects are going to be out earlier, and I agree with Kristen when she's saying that the honeybees would be out there. But our honeybees would fly on a day above 50 degrees, as they would in New York, whether or not there are any blooming flowers out there or not. If the flowers are blooming, the honeybees will be there. What I'm saying basically is that if there are not flowers blooming and there aren't pollen and honey, then they aren't being beneficial to their colony when they're out there. So ultimately, if we have too many warm days before the flowers are out, that will be harmful to the bees.
Well, that's sort of a mismatch. And could there also be a mismatch between when the pollinating insects come out and when the flowers are out, and you're not going to get as much fruit this year because the insects won't be out when the flowers are gone?
Certainly could.
Go ahead, Kristen.
No, that certainly could be. If the pollinators aren't there, then you're not going to have the fruit.
Mm-hmm. And from an entomologist's point of view, I think I would have to point out that in general, the solitary pollinators, we're not talking about the honeybees, but those solitary bees that are our primary pollinators in most of our gardens are probably keyed into the same factors as the plants are. So if we have an early emergence of those plants, I think you can probably imagine there's an early emergence of those pollinators as well. Those two items, plants and the insects, have co-evolved for literally millions of years and probably are keying in on the same environmental factors. So I think the bees, the pollinators, would be out there if those plants are, in fact, blooming.
1-800-989-8255. Denise in Toledo. Hi, Denise.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call. You guys were asking about some of the odd things that we've seen. I love mustard greens, and I'm from Louisiana. But I planted some last summer, and I still have those. They've grown throughout the entire winter this year.
Wow. And they're still producing.
They're still producing, so I may not have to replace them.
I imagine there are other. I wonder if sort of like broccoli and made it through the winter, that sort of thing.
I would imagine a lot of those cold crops, broccoli or kale, even spinach, maybe might have just made it really well through this cool temperature without big snow cover to squish the leaves down into the soil.
Yeah. Well, you see anything else, Denise, growing there?
Just some violas, and I have some other just random plants that have made it through, but I was just really shocked about the greens because usually they're gone, by early December. So,
yeah. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. And does this mean we should go plant things earlier, or we should just wait? Because it seems here, and I know they moved the zones. It seems like we have a 2-week difference. That's how I judge it. It looks now like things are moving 2 weeks ahead than they used to be.
Yeah. I think this winter specifically is a fluke and not really – you can't assume global warming because of one fluky, very, very early winter. But the fact that the USDA has moved us a zone warmer, that's showing longer-term data that they're tracking. And that is real indication that we are becoming warmer.
Mm-hmm. Tom, are you seeing any of the insects moving around, let's say, going further north? Because it's warmer.
Exactly. I would sort of echo what Kristen is saying about this. We are seeing insects that normally don't overwinter as far north as parts of Indiana coming out early in the springtime, suggesting they have overwintered here. What that really indicates is that there are species of insects that aren't really adapted to these winters, and now they're encountering conditions which are allowing them to survive. So I think the movement of the insects further north is as good an indication as the ability of those plants to survive further north as well.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Tell us about skunk cabbage. This was really interesting. And I'm doing our research. You were telling us, Dr. Schleider, about the unusual temperature, the ability of a plant to raise the temperature of itself.
It's really interesting. I was actually just doing some research on this. There's a biologist named Roger Knudsen who discovered that skunk cabbage, in fact, raises its own temperature up to the point where it's an average of 36 degrees above the ambient air temperature for 2 weeks in the spring to help, I'm assuming that it's bringing in the bugs for pollination. It's also, with the heat, it's creating wonderful air circulation in there, spreading its scent further to draw pollinators in. It's just incredibly interesting.
Could it be actually melting a hole through snow that might be there?
Absolutely, yes. It apparently feels warm. If you touch it, it will feel hot.
Okay, Ira. Do you know about that, Tom?
No. I want to find out about this. That's the reason I love Science Fridays. I learn all kinds of things, you know. But insects sort of do the same thing. The honeybees cluster, and the heat of metabolism then raises the temperature in the inside of that cluster up to above 100 degrees Fahrenheit for the incubation of the eggs. Moths will, through muscle contraction, if they're below 50 degrees Fahrenheit, will raise the temperature up to where they can fly. And that's the reason you'll see a moth flying around on a day when the temperature is maybe just about 50 degrees or so. So there we understand that, because that's metabolism in an animal's body. But tell me about that skunk cabbage. How is it raising its temperature?
Apparently, it has large starch stores in its root system, and it's burning it just, you know, they say it uses up oxygen, about as much oxygen as a small mammal in those
couple of
weeks. Yeah, it's amazing.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking about the skunk cabbage and everything else that has to do with the spring this hour on Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Kristen Schleider and Tom Turpin. And let's see if we can, because people are very much eager to talk to us. Let's go to Mandy in Arkansas. Hi, Mandy.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
Doing all right. We're busy in our garden right now. We've gone ahead and just tossed out our USDA map, and we're going with planting everything because it's growing. We have beehives, and our bees are very active right now. They were pollinating our peach trees. But one of the interesting things that we're already seeing, and you can hear all the locals complaining about it, is we've already got mosquitoes.
Wow.
So we're dealing with pests already that we usually only see when it's a lot warmer.
Tom, a comment about that?
Well, I think Mandy wants it both ways. I mean, the bottom line here is that if those bees are going to be out and be active, then those mosquitoes are as well. And here we have a couple of insects that obviously are responding to the increased temperatures by earlier life cycles and things. And it's not surprising. They all respond to the same kind of environmental clues.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, and good luck in your garden, Mandy.
Thank you so much.
You too. Let's go to stay on the phones to Shane in Virginia. Hi, Shane.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey there.
I don't know if either of your guests will be able to help me out on this, but I figured I'd give it a shot. Last year, I went out hunting for morel mushrooms, and I ended up talking to my mom about it, and it turned out I went about 2 or 3 weeks too late. Well, with the weather being, like you mentioned earlier, it's kind of like everything's 2 weeks ahead of schedule. I wanted to know if either of your guests or you yourself or if any other listener might have some advice on, I know in Virginia, typically your morel time is towards the end of April to the very first week of May. Generally, like Mother's Day is always the cutoff, and you're pretty much done by then. So I wanted to know if maybe I should go like the first and second week of April rather than towards the end of April, since the weather's so much warmer than normal.
You should have called one our fungus experts.
Exactly. You've got a botanist and an entomologist here, but I'll tell you what, this old bug guy from Indiana is also a morel hunter, and I go out in my own woods and look for them. I'm not going out on a calendar date anymore at all. I use some of the phenological indicators, the plants out there, and they've been out a little bit earlier the last year or two, and I've found the first morels a couple of weeks earlier than I have. So I would agree with that observation.
Thanks for calling, Shane. And in a minute we have left, Kristen, what's going on in the garden? What's going on out there to come out and see that's blooming?
Well, outside, we've got daffodils by the score. We've got the winter hazels are starting. The first magnolia I saw, Magnolia stellata, in full bloom. I know. But inside the conservatory, we have our orchid show on right now, which is really extraordinary and just a wonderful place to sit and be cozy and look at a beautiful display.
Tom, you've got something you'd like to tell us about? Come
well, on. I was going to say that I think Kristen's cheating. She's got the inside kind of a thing. And we can go into our bug barn and watch all kinds of insects being active there as well. But the truth is, I think we have seen a lot more activity this year of early season insect activity, including, I've got to admit, that I was bitten by a mosquito at the end of February in my bedroom this year, and I'm not liking that at all.
Wow. There you have it. Can't get better, you know, first person reporting than that. Thank you very much, Tom. Tom Turpin is professor of entomology at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. And Kristen Schleider is acting director of outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Pluto, the planet. Not the planet, the... Sort of. Well, it depends on who you ask. We'll talk about Pluto and a mission to Pluto, and there's a push to actually get a new stamp for Pluto and the mission to the body of. We'll talk about it when we get back. Stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork, and we think it's a real trend. And we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next week marks the 82nd anniversary of the discovery of Pluto, and depending on whom you ask, Pluto is or was our ninth planet. Pluto's status as a dwarf planet, a mere Kuiper-belt object, is still a topic of hot debate. But planet or not, Pluto is getting a visitor. The New Horizons mission was launched in 2006, and it's headed out on its 3-billion-mile road trip to the Kuiper Belt. That's a long way, but the spacecraft is making good time. It's traveling at about 34,000 miles per hour and scheduled to fly by Pluto in 2015. And if the mission's leaders have their way, that's about the same time that they would like the U.S. Postal Service to roll out a new commemorative stamp honoring Pluto. We'll talk about that more in a few more minutes. But first, here to talk to me about Pluto and the mission to visit it is Alan Stern. He is principal investigator of the New Horizons mission to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, and he's based at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Stern.
Hi, Ira. Happy Ben.
Hey, nice to have you with us. You know, depending to which part of the country you go to, I remember going, we were just out in Arizona, and you talked to any scientist in Arizona, and Pluto is still a planet out there. And I guess it's in your...
You know, it's not just in Arizona.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's in your neck of the woods, too.
Well, you know, Pluto's oftentimes maligned, but, you know, people don't realize it's a big place. If you drove around the equator of Pluto, it's as far as from New York City all the way to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. And so there are diehard Pluto advocates who are going to continue to push that and continue not to believe that Pluto is not a planet.
Well, you know, we've discovered in the last 15 years that the solar system is littered with a smaller class of planet called dwarf planets.
Right.
And some people are having a hard time accepting the fact that what they were taught when they were children, that they were only... you know, a small number of planets isn't the case. It's too bad, but just like Galileo discovering there are so many stars you can't name them all, there are so many planets that you can't name them all, and we just need to get used to the data.
Yeah. Let's talk about the mission that was launched in 2006. How far have we gotten? Where is the spacecraft at this point?
Yeah, thanks for asking. New Horizons is now about two-thirds of the way from here to Pluto. It's out between the orbits of Uranus and Neptune and headed to an encounter just over 3 years from now.
3 years from now. And I read somewhere that this was the fastest man-made craft ever built. Is that true?
We are the fastest spacecraft ever launched, set records, speed records for reaching the orbit of the moon in just 9 hours, reaching Jupiter in just 13 months. Compare that, for example, to Galileo, the NASA Galileo mission. It took 6 years to get to Jupiter. We are speeding across the solar system.
And what happens when you get there? What is the mission?
The mission is two parts. Our first part is to reconnoiter the Pluto system, Pluto and all of its moons, during the early months and middle months of 2015, a multi-month encounter, and then we will go on deeper into this new region of the solar system, the Kuiper Belt, with the intention of flying by one or very possibly two small Kuiper Belt objects, roughly the size of counties, things that are, you know, the building blocks of the planet.
Mm-hmm. And how is Pluto discovered? This being the 82nd anniversary, what was the process? Was it searched for? Was it by accident?
It was searched for, in fact, for about 25 years, from 1905 to 1930. Various astronomers looked for what they then called Planet X. And a very young man working for Lowell Observatory, Clyde Tombaugh, who at that time didn't even have his doctorate in astronomy, made the discovery, largely through just hard work, in the winter of 1930.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't have modern telescopes, but that was a pretty good telescope. Still around.
That telescope does still exist. The telescope's pretty good, but what's most amazing is, you know, just the persistence and the careful attention to detail, because what we would now turn over to computers for mind-numbing data analysis, he did by hand and by eye in 1930, comparing one photograph to another to look for moving objects with, you know, ridiculous numbers of stars to filter out in his mind and look for this find. And he never reported a false discovery. All the time that he was working for Lowell, the only time he came to his boss, he'd actually found a planet.
Now, I understand that some of his ashes are actually on the spacecraft.
That's true.
Is there a plaque or an urn, or how is it being carried?
Yeah, he requested that after he passed, that he be cremated, and that if there was a mission to Pluto, that some of his ashes be included. And we honored that request. About an ounce of Professor Tombaugh's ashes are on the spacecraft in a small metal box that's welded to the spacecraft, which is actually used as a small balance weight. There's a plaque next to it about his discovering the Pluto system. And along with some other commemorative items, they're on their way not just to Pluto, but out of our solar system into the stars.
Interesting. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. The Pluto New Horizons team is also on another mission. I mentioned it before. They're hoping to get the U.S. Postal Service to issue a commemorative stamp honoring Pluto and the New Horizons spacecraft. And you can see the concept for the stamp on our website at sciencefriday.com. And there's a link to a petition there as well. And the proposed stamp, if you look at it, it shows the spacecraft, and it's set against the backdrop of Pluto. And here to talk more about it, better to describe it than I can, is the artist who designed it. Dan Derda is an astronomical artist. In his day job, he's a principal scientist at the Southwest Research Institute, and he's designed several images for the New Horizons missions. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Derda.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be with you.
Tell us about this petition.
Well, it's Alan Stern's brainchild. Back in the 1990s, there was a Exploring the Planets stamp series that was commemorating the very first missions to various planets. And poor little Pluto back then just simply had the words "not yet explored." And that sort of stuck in the craw of the folks who were trying to get a mission to go to Pluto. And so Alan vowed way back then that if we ever had a mission to go off to Pluto, it was going to have a new stamp associated with it. And so we've been working very hard to get this new stamp issued.
The first stamp is on the spacecraft, correct?
The first stamp Alan actually had put on the spacecraft, that's correct. There's a sample of it there, kind of a little bit of a poke in the eye to the general idea.
And what does it take to get a new stamp then?
Well, there's a standard process through the U.S. Post Office website. There's effectively a short written proposal that goes in, along with an actual bit of concept art for the stamp, at least for the idea for the stamp that you'd like to propose. And then also associated with that is a petition process to show that there's, you know, interest on the part of the general public in having a stamp like that.
1-800-989-8255. Lots of listeners want to call in. Let's take a few calls. Philip in San Rafael, hi.
Hi.
Hi there, Phil. Go ahead.
I just have a simple question. Pluto is so far away from the sun, it must be very dim out there. There's not much sunlight. So will the New Horizons spacecraft be able to get the same kinds of spectacular photographs that, you know, Voyager and other satellites have gotten?
Alan, what do you say?
Yeah, the answer is yes. The sunlight's about 1,000 times dimmer than it here is here at high noon. It's about like twilight conditions on the Earth, actually, and all of our cameras and spectrometers are designed to operate at that light level. In fact, they're much better at it than the Voyager cameras were, so hold on to your hat. We expect to deliver eye-popping imagery.
Wow, we'll look forward to that. Rona in let me get Rona on here. Rona in Marble Canyon, Arizona. Hi, Rona.
Yeah, that's right, Ira. I've called before. Yes, I think that Pluto should have its own stamp, but you better use the mail, not just the email, if you want to have a new stamp.
And there won't be much. There won't be a mail system left, is what you're saying, to use your
well,
stamp.
There's a plan. The head of the post office and the union have a plan, but Congress has to pass it.
Yeah.
Aha. Anyway, and may I say that I'm a loyal and avid listener, and I'm going to be 80 tomorrow, Myra.
Happy birthday.
And I listen to Science Friday every time I say, oh, I really want to live a long time so I can be around when all these wonderful things happen.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you 80 years from now again, hopefully.
Oh, I don't think so.
Happy birthday, Rona.
But I'm with you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Thank
Bez.
You.
Very
Bye.
Nice. Very nice for you to say. 1-800-989-8255. Can you, Dan, could you describe the stamp for us a little bit more?
Sure, yeah. So we wanted to show the excitement, really, of the New Horizons encounter with this really geologically, meteorologically interesting world. And so I, working with Alan, tried to come up with a bit of a concept that showed that this is going to be an interesting world. It's not just some boring ice ball. It's known to have some pretty significant color and brightness contrast across the surface that implies that there's going to be some interesting geology to see. Alan can describe a lot more of the detail of the what we know about the interesting atmosphere that's at this small world. So we've put a lot of that in the artwork as well.
Alan, has there been a great deal of backlash since Pluto was officially taken out of the realm of planets?
Yeah, you might remember in 2006 when the astronomy community made their quick vote on short notice that the planetary science community came back, hundreds of experts in planetary science who said, no, wait a minute, we're not buying that. We know a planet when we see one. Astronomers should stay out of planetary science. Apparently they don't know what they're talking about. Since then, what I found is that most people you talk to about what is and isn't a planet, I think it's pretty clear the tide has turned, and people appreciate that these small planets are planets, too. They have all the same attributes. For example, Pluto has not just geology and an atmosphere and a system of moons, but polar caps and seasons and all the things that you normally associate with a planet. And so just like a chihuahua is still a dog because it has all the attributes of a dog, these smaller worlds turn out to be a big surprise, a wonderful discovery, actually, that the outer solar system is littered in planets that are thousands of miles around but still smaller than the Earth and gargantuan Jupiter, and that we need to count them, too, in the population of planets, because after all, they have all the attributes of planets.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Alan Stern and Dan Derda. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Alan, you think the tide is turning? You said the tide is turning a little bit. They're not going to reverse a decision, do you think?
Well, I don't know. The astronomers can do what the astronomers do, but they're not really in their realm of expertise when they're talking about planetary science, although planets are in space, but they're not stars. They're not galaxies.
So your argument is that we should not leave the designation of a planet to astronomers. We should talk more to terrestrial scientists?
Well, no, to planetary scientists, people who actually study planets rather than faraway galaxies, for example. But my real point to you, Ira, is that the IAU sort of meddled in an area where they're not particularly expert and further came up with a poor definition. In fact, by the IAU's definition, even an Earth out in the Kuiper Belt, if you put the Earth there, the IAU would not consider it a planet because of the poor definition that they constructed. And by the way, the definition was specifically constructed to limit the number of planets in the solar system, and that's sort of an anti-scientific concept in and of itself, to arrange the answer to be the one you want.
Well, I think we have to have a little smackdown here between you and your opponents, I think. It could be an interesting discussion, because
I'd be happy to do something like that if you want to arrange it. That'd be fun.
Well, we'll arrange it. I did this years ago with Neil deGrasse Tyson and now I'm going to have a senior moment. Can't remember from Tucson.
That was Mark Sykes.
Mark Sykes, thank you. Yes, it was Mark Sykes, and it was very, very interesting. And they'll have to revisit it.
And I remember once doing your show with Mike Brown on this topic, and Mike Brown said to you that we're just not going to be able to have 50 planets in the solar system. His daughter wouldn't be able to remember the names of all of them. And you might remember that I shot back, well, then, Mike, I guess we're going to have to go back to 8 states as well, if that's the criteria.
You want to come on with Mike Brown?
Sure. Okay. Name, a time, and place.
All right. You know, I feel like, it is Arizona and New Mexico without the Southwest.
And Mike is a tremendous astronomer, and he's discovered so many things, and he's a very fun and funny guy, and frankly, he should get credit for the planets he's discovered.
Right. Right. We'll bring California in, we'll get Mike Brown, we'll have a, just like in the Old West, we'll have a showdown, right? We don't have a street long enough, but we'll make one happen here right on Science Friday. And
we'll arrange it to be high noon somewhere. That sounds great.
It's always high noon somewhere when we're on. But before we go, tell us everything. So everything is normal on the spaceship. It's working well. It's, as they used to say in the space industry, it's nominal, and things are happening just like you expected on schedule.
Absolutely. As we also say in the spacecraft business, everything's just tickety-boo. We're a very healthy spacecraft with lots of fuel, lots of power. We're not using any of our backup systems. We are two-thirds of the way to our objective, and really looking forward to the encounter. We are heavily involved right now in writing all the observing sequences, the backup plans, all that.
Wow.
And we are really looking forward to first-time exploration like people haven't seen in a long, long time.
That will be interesting. Also, there's a lot of work. Dan Derta's work as an artist is on our website at sciencefriday.com/art. So we have a SciArt site there, right there in Science Friday, dedicated to science and the arts. And we have some great great drawings by Dan and artwork from Dan on there on the website. I want to thank both of you for taking
time
to be with us. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Ira.
Dan Derta is a principal scientist at the Southwest Research Institute. He's also an astronomical artist, and Alan Stern is the principal investigator of the New Horizons mission to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Amisha Serene Anand. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch is our technical director. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.